resisted going back into the body because it was so much fun out there. I mean, it was just absolute freedom and love, and God was all around, and it was just like, wow, this is great. I didn't go down a tunnel. I didn't meet an actual being of light, because the being was everywhere in the universe, and it would talk to me if I talked to it. It was like kind of interesting. I don't think it was in English. It was more like in pictures and feelings and stuff like that. Then thereafter, so to get into my body, which was dehydrated, I had just run 26, you know, marathons, 26.2 miles. I had run 26.1 of those miles. My thighs were just, you know, burning, and my body was feeling very fragile. I didn't want to get in there. It just felt like going back into a trap, and but I did. And I was at that point being rushed at 85 miles an hour to Vassar Hospital, and I was put on IV.
And Dorothy still had her hand over you. She never took it off all the way into the hospital.
Yeah.
She went right in.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was raving. I was really out of my mind. And thereafter, Robin has been through a number of these things with me, and she was very sweet as usual and stayed with me in the hospital there. I was in the hospital for about a week, I think. Both the climbing fall and the marathon accident. And then I was very emotional after that, because I was already a bloke with a couple of head injuries. And this heart destabilization was really fascinating, because I was really all out there in the marathon. I was in the last stretch of the marathon. I was giving it everything that I got at this 95-degree temperature. Thereafter, when I would go to my psychotherapy office, and I would listen to somebody who was suffering tell their story, I was given the gift of tears. I couldn't stop it. They would just run down my face, and my clients would look astonished, and I would say, don't worry, I'm empathizing with you. I mean, but it was really, I would feel people's pain. I could even sometimes feel it before they came into the room. I would feel what was going on. I was quite visionary and quite crazy, like I told you about when you've had a head injury, your ESP and stuff like that opens up. Most people who have authentic ESP, by the way, don't seek for it. They would rather not have it. you know what I mean? It's yeah. Yes.
I'm wondering what your perceived time.
What was the perceived time during this period when you were having the experience?
Eternity.
So you weren't in real time.
I was not in. That's not real time. This isn't real time. That was real time. I've known that ever since. I became known as an unusually empathic therapist, and my practice started filling up more and more, because I was like this guy with the strange gift of tears, and my heart, I was empathizing with people all the time. I was empathizing with people all over the world. If I would hear about a tragedy, I would cry. Wilson Van Dusen also had this gift, by the way. Whenever he would talk to people and get close to something spiritually meaningful, he would just begin weeping. And crowds, audiences, he talked to sometimes hundreds of people, were very moved by it. So you asked, I told.
And thank you.
Yeah. And I've never feared death since then. Never feared death. I fear losing loved ones. I fear tragedy around me. I fear, being crippled by something horrible where I'm still in my body and I can't move very well or something like that. That would be kind of awful. But I'm not afraid of death. As Joseph Campbell said to us in the last time we were with him physically, we were writing, we had just finished vetting Robin's book and a new film we had made at the Swedenborg Foundation called The Other Side of Life, about death and dying. We got into a cab with Joe, and we were going down to Brooklyn Heights to see his wife Jean's theater piece performing. And he turned around from the front seat and looked Robin and me in the eye, and he said, you know, I'm not afraid of death. I just don't want to be there when it happens. He was quoting Woody Allen. He had a wonderful way of doing that. I probably feel the same way. I'm not sure. I do want to be there when it happened.
Joe said his greatest
wish was that he would be conscious at his moment of death, and he was.
Yeah, he was conscious, and he did refuse any kind of painkillers or anything that would affect his consciousness.
Yeah, a young Catholic priest saw his name, realized that he was probably Roman Catholic, and came to see him in the hospital in Honolulu. He suffered from esophageal cancer and came to see him, and he said, "Father, thank you so much for coming to me." And the father said, "Would you like to have the last rites?" And Joseph Campbell showed him that he was reading the Bhagavad Gita in Sanskrit and in English, and he said, "I don't think so, Father, but thank you so much for coming to see me." And he went home. It was really kind of a hospice-type situation, and he was on his way to his writing desk. Jean was in the apartment when he just died on his feet. He was on his feet, heading towards his writing desk, working on the Historical Atlas of World Mythology, which is exactly what he wanted to be doing. A beautiful, beautiful apartment in Honolulu on Waikiki Beach, with a view out over the Pacific Ocean. And that's where he spent his last 5 years, by the way. And I tried, in my 50s, I tried replicating one of his... He swam at least 1,000 yards a day, either in the YMCA or when he went to Hawaii. He did it in the open sea. So I tried replicating one of his swimming feats, and I ended up out in the Pacific Ocean with these rip tides, and I saw people being sucked out to sea around me. I'm a pretty strong swimmer, but it was all I could do to get my tail back to land myself. It was really pretty impressive what he used to do. Yes?
I just...
Point it right at your mouth, hon.
I thought it was right on my mouth. All right. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, much better.
I just wanted to ask about, with TBI, sometimes isn't there a part of the brain that can affect the ability for compassion? What part of the brain that...
Remember,
I know with autism, it's
the brain is not a compartmentalized thing. Is compassion found somewhere? I think compassion is found somewhere else in the body. Because they're not in their hearts. The heart has its own brain. The heart has its own intelligence. There are 40,000 neurons in here. There are 300 million neurons in your gut. It's a brain of its own. Is compassion found in the brain? Possibly also in the mirror neurons, because the mirror neurons give you the ability to put yourself in somebody else's place. So, but they're distributed all over the brain. Yeah, oh, wait till you get the mic.
Okay.
Oh. Somebody has
priority. I have the mic. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay.
So I wanted to, this idea of fundamentalism, and I got the impression that you're saying or suggesting that we be more empathetic because of the difficulty with the brain, therefore it affected their belief. And I just was hoping that there's more of a hopeful outcome with the, it's like this is the way it is, and unless there is an external force that would help them with their thinking, that's it in terms of the negativity.
It's very interesting. The brain is a self-protective organ. And with neurofeedback, we really cure a lot of the immediate symptoms of traumatic brain injury, including the emotional upheavals, the cognitive cloud, the problems with memory. A lot of those can go away much faster than we have any right to believe they can go away. But that's because we are not changing the physical apparatus of the brain. We are changing the neurological self-blockades that the brain has put on certain areas. When you have a head injury, the brain doesn't want to do a seizure, and so it secretes inhibitory neurotransmitters, the most famous of which is GABA, and it blockades off. It's like a quarantine, and people get stupid in those quarantines. And when somebody starts to have seizures or wild emotions, what do they give them? They give them a GABA agonist like Neurontin, and they get really dull and dumb and all kinds of things like that, because most of the allopathic psychotropic drugs don't work very well. They're just like massive inundations of biochemistry into the brain. With neurofeedback, it's much more particular. We can kind of break some of those blockades loose, stimulate parts of the brain that thought they were dead, wake them up, and gradually then, in the best cases, people who begin to, let's say, recover their powers, like with cognitive exercises or lumosity or just simply going out more, or the best things you can do for your brain, learn a language, new language, study music,
exercise.
Find your way around strange cities.
Exercise.
Read a book is not bad.
Exercise.
Exercise is wonderful. Now, any of those things.
Yeah, it's all here.
I missed that. Oh, donate to, go to a conference. Think hard about fundamentalism.
Yeah.
Talk to a fundamentalist and realize you're not one. Woo. Or maybe you are one in certain kinds of ways. And yeah, I'm going to.
I have a question here.
Oh, there's one down here, and then we can do that. Yes.
Okay. I just attended a little group on Friday before I came here, and we were talking about the brain. We were talking about the brain.
Yeah.
And this friend of mine has written this book, and he was talking about compassion and the brain, and it's something about the anterior cingulate. So there is a part of the brain of the anterior cingulate, and then it kind of gets
not
into the midbrain.
Not the anterior cingulate, but probably the insula.
Maybe, yeah, okay. I mean, I can't remember.
The anterior cingulate is it's more concerned with OCD-like stuff, okay. Rituals and that kind of thing.
But
the insula is where you have self-image and image about other people.
But anyway, he was talking about compassion
same area,
in the brain.
Yeah.
And a couple other things, when you were talking about the revenge of the right hemisphere, I was thinking of David Grand's work with brain spotting. Are you familiar with him?
No, David?
David Grand. Grand. Grand, G-R-A-N-D, yeah.
He's a practitioner of EMDR, studied with Francine Shapiro.
Uh-huh.
But he does brain spotting, and he patches one side of the one eye.
Uh-huh. If you'll email me about that, I can look it up. I'd like to learn more about it.
And can I mention one more thing?
Sure.
About epigenetics?
Pardon me?
Epigenetics?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Okay. Can you say anything about epigenetics?
Sure. You know, there used to be this old debate between Lamarck and DeVries, I guess it was, and can we change our genes? And they said, no, the science of epigenetics shows that we can change our genes. They're genes that can be switched on and off, and the environment, a rich environment, switches the genes on. So guess what? You're in a rich environment right now, and your genes are getting switched on. And there was something else I was going to say that slipped my mind just before you asked your very interesting question.
About the cingulate?
Pardon me?
Not the cingulate. I mean about the
About the repair of the brain.
Yeah.
Elizabeth Gould of Princeton University about 10 years ago found neural plasticity. It was followed by Alvaro Pascual Leone of Harvard, and the previous orthodoxy of brain science going back to Cajal, Santiago Ramon y Cajal said neurons do not regenerate themselves. That's been the doctrine for almost an entire century until Elizabeth Gould found populations of cells that were repopulating themselves in the brain. Pascual Leone found blind people who were making braille maps in their brains. And these are legitimate scientists, well-respected, and the whole atmosphere began to change. Neural plasticity. Read my friend Norman Doidge's book, The Brain That Changes Itself. It's well-written, and it's well-researched, and it's great. But it usually takes a long time to do that, and that's why I was saying yesterday that Len Oakes's thing of we can cure anybody in a couple of sessions, that's only if you're curing what's called the passive kind of the injury, the dynamic energetic injury. It doesn't repair neurons that. You can't repair structural. I could call it functional
quickly.
Repair, not structural repair.
Yeah, not quickly, but.
Yeah. Yes.
Two questions. Can you elaborate a little bit more about personalizing mythological material, making your personal mythology is something you talk about, and also you know, more flaky than the New Age fundamentalists or people who run around calling themselves shamans. And mm-hmm. what advice do you have approaching shamanistic yes. material and how to work with it? And
I have had over the years many people coming who tell me that they are shamans. And I go, oh yeah? What culture made you so? A true shaman only is a shaman in relationship to their culture. And people go up and they say, well, you're Steve Larson, you're a shaman. I go, no. I'm a psychotherapist. I'm trained in Western psychological thinking, and I'm trained in the neurology of the brain. I'm not trained to be a shaman, and I never would pretend to be it. I did practice something called spirit releasement for a while, and I trained with a guy who was really pretty good at it. A fellow named Bill Baldwin. Did you hear about him when you were studying with Roger Wilger? No, he was great. He wrote the Spirit Releasement Handbook. It's quite powerful, quite interesting. He thinks it's the hollow self theory. He thinks, like Wilson Van Dusen said, that, and like Swedenborg said, that we are hollow vessels and spirits come and go in us. You know, somebody will come to you and say, oh, you're in good spirits today. Well, yes, I am. Oh, you're in bad spirits today. Mm-hmm. We are permeable. We are semi-permeable entities. And the old wise people weren't so bad when they cast out evil spirits. Remember the scene in the New Testament where there's a guy named Legion? He's possessed by 1,000 demons. And he comes towards Jesus and goes, boy, have I been waiting for you, Master. And Jesus casts the evil spirits out of him into a herd of pigs, not very kind to the swine herds, into a herd of pigs, and they go rushing down to the Sea of Galilee and throw themselves in. And
yes, right.
What was the aftermath of that? I'm trying to remember, besides the loss of a lot of pigs.
They got scared and ran Jesus out of town, told him to leave.
Yeah. Oh, they did?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's what happens with shamans, especially when they hurt the livestock, you know. And Jesus was always doing that. He was always exorcising evil spirits, and his metaphors were, what good shall it do a man if he have seven evil spirits and you clean the house and get them out and then he takes on seven even worse. I thought he's like somebody who lives in a fraternity house. You know, you've got these evil roommates who are drunken and messy and all kinds of things and leave condoms everywhere and you get rid of them and then you get an even worse batch.
I just, since you're speaking of shamans, this is actually a good time. I heard you mention ayahuasca and it sounded like you've had experience with that, and then you said you were in LSD experiments, so.
Oh yeah.
You know, I'm kind of curious what your comments on those topics would be and like how they relate to one another, because you know people say, oh, it's a drug, it's DMT, it's like an acid trip, it's not, you know, this spiritual experience people claim to have.
Can I say something to this, Steve? And then,
yeah,
and then you
I dragged Robin along
a little bit
to these
about
ceremonies
this the other day but with someone, but drugs are pharmaceuticals, and I, as I mentioned to someone I was talking with, they come from an environment that is bathed in money and blood and greed, and there's something else. The visionary vegetables, the sacred plants that are used in cultures all over the world, the grape being the one most familiar to Christians, these are, first of all, they are natural plant beings.